and my special guest in the studio this afternoon. He grew up in Adelaide, worked in R&B bands in Sydney during the 1980s, and then spent 18 years in London working with artists such as Eric Clapton, Sting, B.B. King, Van Morrison. He led his own groups in London, jazz funk groups, and worked with artists such as Jim Mullen, John Etheridge and Carl Orr. Now, he's about to release the second album from his abiding hard bop band Hammerhead, following up on Mosaic, which was released back in 2014. This time it's entitled, as I mentioned, Turning Point. Jason Brewer, welcome back to Now's the Time.
Thanks for having me.
Jason, it's been over 10 years since we last spoke on Now's the Time. Hard to believe.
I know, that is hard to believe.
But back then, we learned a lot about your early influences, such as Pink Floyd, Weather Report, John Coltrane. Can you please remind us how you came to love music and became interested in the saxophone? We also already mentioned that you travelled to London, but you travelled there straight after school and then went back after being influenced by the scene in London. Clearly highly influential on you returning for basing yourself there for 18 years.
Yeah, look, it's an interesting story. You've got an incredible memory for 10 years since we spoke, all of that stuff. Look, I had a sort of slightly different introduction to music because I took up the saxophone quite late in life. I was sort of nearly 19, and I did have a stint in London after I left school because my father was studying over there. And I met a guy, I was just working, I wasn't a muso, I was going out and binging on all the bands that I grew up with through the 70s, you know, everybody from Pink Floyd to Genesis to, you know, Black Sabbath, you know, and I met a guy that was a bit older than me that was a real jazz head, and he turned me on to Weather Report and John Coltrane, and it was like, wow. You know, it didn't suddenly make me think, right, I've got to become a jazz musician. But it just, I think, over that period of 1976 to 1977, which was also the height of the punk era in London, it was an incredible, you know, period of time to be over there. Something kind of clicked and I came back to Australia and Adelaide back then and didn't really know what I was going to do and drifted around and reconnected with some old school friends that were all sort of playing music and had sort of, you know, unbeknownst to me, were sort of playing even when I knew them prior to going to London and had sort of hooked up with some other musos from other areas and I used to go along to jam sessions and rehearsals and just think, wow, this is cool. But still, it took a while for it to kind of hit me, you know. And then, so basically, just before my 19th birthday, I decided that I wanted to be a saxophone player. So I hired a saxophone, then I bought a saxophone, and it was just like this. It was a incredible kind of feeling that, right, this is what I want to do. I was so incredibly focused. I practiced literally 8 or 9 hours a day for 3 years so I could audition at the Con in Adelaide and do the jazz course there. And I figured that if I practiced that much for 3 years, I'd sort of get up to the standard that would be required to get in. And I did, and I got in. And soon after that, I joined a band called Fat Time, who were a sort of West Coast R&B band. And after 2 years, that band sort of outgrew Adelaide, and I decided that would be my gateway out of Adelaide to Sydney. So I brought that band up to Sydney, a couple of personnel changes, and we became quite a well-known band over a pretty short period of time in Sydney. Worked up to 300 shows a year, toured pretty much constantly, supported Joan Armour Trading, Santana, Joe Cocker, Casey and the Sunshine Band, were in and out of TV studios, on the road, and it was an incredible experience. And for some reason, that band sort of went by the wayside, and then I just found myself drawn back to London. Even though I was like really successful as a freelance musician in Sydney, I just was drawn back to London. And then, as you mentioned before, I had all of those incredible experiences over there playing with people that, you know, if you told me when I was 15 that I'd be sharing the stage with Eric Clapton or somebody like that, I would have just laughed out loud, you know. So take some risks. And, you know, that's what I say to all my young students. If they ever ask me, you know, about advice, I say just take risks.
And of course, the practice. You know, when you're talking eight hours a day practice, that's what really gets amazing results.
Well, look, you just have to put in, because look, I teach a lot now. I'd start kids off when they're about 7 or 8 on clarinet or saxophone. And I've had a couple of students that I've done that who are now at the Con. One in particular, a young guy called Ned Olive, who's doing really well. I started him when he was 7. Now he's in his second year at the Con. And, you know, by the time he left school, he was at a very, very high standard, could sight read really well. He probably sight read better than me by the time I finished teaching him. And I was up against guys like that, you know, having started at that age.
Yes.
You know, so I had to put in those hours. And that they talk about that sort of 10,000 hours.
Yes.
And I'm not exaggerating. I reckon I came close to that just in practice hours in that 3 years. And I was nowhere. Like, you know, I was a very average young saxophone player after that much practice. So 10,000 hours on an instrument doesn't equate to much in terms of a level of expertise, in my opinion. Mm. It might in some industries, in some areas of work, but I don't think music. You know, I think it's, you know, obviously I got to the point where I was able to get through the audition, but the standard wasn't particularly high, I didn't think, in Adelaide at that time. But anyway, that's how it panned out.
Now, the first outing for Hammerhead clearly had its roots in the hard bop tradition.
Yep.
But your involvement in a broad array of genres here in Sydney with the soul scene, the funk and blues, obviously those sort of things seep through into your writing for Hammerhead and I think on this album.
Yeah.
You call it music for the now rather than the then. Is there a specific intention behind the new album's title, Turning Point? Or what was the theme?
It's really hard coming up with a title. You know, a lot of albums, you know, you pick one of the track names and call it that. Or, you know, obviously when it's if it's an instrumental album, it makes it a bit harder. And I was really struggling. I had a few names. Conversations was one. Breaking Bad was one. I ran a few of them by the band. Nothing really stuck. And then I thought, the direction on this has changed from the first album. The personnel is a bit different. I made some changes to the band a year ago because I was sort of wanting to break out of that sort of, you know, 50s, 60s hard bop blue note mould, whilst, you know, still honouring that great sound and being very inspired by that music. I wanted to do some different things, which I felt needed a different approach from different musicians. So I changed half the band or more and set about turning the band into an all-original project. So it was, you know, it became sort of all of my
compositions.
All my compositions. Now, obviously, there's a trace of hard bop in there, but there's a lot of other styles, I think, that come across because of, you know, I've survived in the music industry for 40 years and you can't do that playing jazz, really.
Mm. You know? We all know that.
Yeah, and look, I don't want to exclusively play jazz, you know. Like, I love playing a lot of styles. So it's impossible for that, you know, not to have some kind of effect on the music that I've written over the last 3 or 4 years.
There was a quote on Facebook today, while I think of it, Quincy Jones, if you're thinking about the dollars, God has left the room. So I think that must mean that God surrounds every jazz musician.
Well, you understand the word sycophant. Well, this is my sort of reaction to a lot of people's alter egos on social media.
Okay.
Where people sort of, I think, overtly praise certain things that I don't feel are very praiseworthy, and they might say something different to them behind their back, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very different world. People that you think you know, you sort of see a very different side of them on Facebook. Obviously, sycophanticide is a fairly dark word if you take the literal meaning of it.
Yes.
But it just, I don't know, it just came to me when I wrote that song. So
I was going to ask you about Blues for Jonesy. Is this a dedication to your friend Ian Jones? Is
that... Look, that tune, yes, is written for Ian, a dear friend of mine that passed away in 2007. And, you know, I always like to dedicate songs at some point to you know, my precious friends and family, etc. And it's an interesting story because I came home after having a colonoscopy, actually, and I was still feeling the effects of the anaesthetic. I was feeling pretty spaced out, but, you know, really elated that I'd got through the operation and everything was clear. And I got home and I can't remember, I think my wife was in London at the time, my kids were out and I was just home on my own. And I opened a beer and then was for some reason drawn into my studio and sat down at the piano and started playing these sort of this bass line, and, you know, the song developed and I pretty much wrote the whole thing in one sitting, which is unusual for me. And I was going to call it the colonoscopy blues, but I thought that didn't really have a very good ring about it. No pun intended there. So I was thinking about Ian a lot at that time, you know, when you lose somebody. And look, you don't think about them every day. Sometimes you do, but sometimes you go through a period where you think about that person a lot. And I was thinking of Ian a lot at that time, so I just called it Blues for Jonesy.
You've also shared the trumpet honours with both Cam McAllister and Simon Frenchy. Now, tell us the idea behind that.
Look, it's the previous trumpet player, like I'd replaced a fabulous trumpet player on the previous album, Ray Kassar, that just got so insanely busy with four young kids and it was just difficult for him to commit to the Wednesday night residency the band had. So we sort of, he agreed to step down, and Cam is a good mate and a fabulous player and composer and arranger, and he seemed to be the obvious choice to come in. And because of his Navy band commitments often, he's not available. So it ended up being that Simon Ferenczi probably did as many gigs, if not more gigs, than Cam, because, you know, Simon's also, you know, one of my favourite trumpet players in Sydney, if not Australia. I think he's a really wonderful player. So I kind of thought it'd be cool to have both these guys on the album, you know, because Simon's done at least as many gigs as Cam, if not more, and is quite a different stylist to Cam.
That's right.
And so I kind of, they both came in and did a day each in the studio, and that's how it worked. So,
and you've got the drummer Alex Herlihan.
Yes.
That's an interesting move.
Yes. Well, look, I wanted to change things up. I saw Alex play with Mike Rivett one night at 505, and I just thought, wow. I'd heard the name. In fact, I used to do gigs with his mum back in the day, and I'd heard the name Dave Thiek. I mentioned him quite a few times. He used to use him in his organ trio, and I went and saw him, and I just thought, this guy's incredible. And, you know, when they're that age, every time you hear them, they just get better. And he's, Alex, for me, is the best young jazz drummer in Australia.
Well, he won the National Jazz Award, didn't he?
He won the National Jazz Award for very, you know, very good reason. I think the other two finalists were absolutely brilliant as well. But I did think Alex deserved to win it. And he's an exciting young player. He really understands the style. You know, you never quite know what's going to happen, and that's, you know, that's what jazz is about to me. The unpredictable can be just wonderful, and he's a fabulous talent, and I'll have him for as long as I can.
And of course, Greg Coffin, what an outstanding
Greg
pianist.
He's, you know, one of the finest players in the country without doubt. You know, I mean, you could probably put a list together of 10 incredible jazz pianists, and he's going to be
on that list
without doubt. If not top 5 or 6, you know. He's incredible. We've been mates for quite a few years. So he's been in the band just after Mosaic was released. So Greg's been in there for quite some time. And Andrew Robertson is the only one, the alto player. He's been there right from the beginning.
What changes in regulation would you make if you could improve conditions for live music in Sydney?
Look, the lockout laws of, you know, like the whole scene was on the wane for a variety of reasons. The lockout laws was just the hammer blow. Over-regulation in New South Wales is just completely outrageous. Like, I mean, Sydney has become the laughing stock of the world, whereas in the 80s, as you well know, 70s, 80s, Sydney had the most vibrant music scene like anywhere in the world, or as good. It's been a slow demise. I've been back from England for 13 years. In that time, it has radically changed. There's still a lot of incredible music being made it's all sort of going underground. Like great piano player Aaron Blakey posted last Tuesday night this list of bands that were on, and there was like 8 or 10, you know, really good bands playing in various venues around Sydney. A lot of sort of underground venues that aren't mainstream, that, you know, I might only get 20 or 30 people to. So that's where it's going. Mm. And certainly in the jazz world, it's got to the point where, you know, it's like nobody does it for money, you know. So, you know, if you're lucky enough to be involved in a commercial sort of wedding or corporate band, that's where you're going to make your money. But even, you know, duos in hotel lobbies and stuff like that, they're just, they don't exist anymore. I think in the last 2.5 years, 190 odd venues have closed because of the overregulation. There are licensing cops harassing venues for no reason other than, well, we don't even know. You know, there's been the parliamentary inquiry into the live music industry. I sat in on one of the sessions at Parliament House and listened to some submissions. And the Labor government promised to act on every single recommendation if they were elected. Sadly, they weren't elected. And interestingly, the coalition made no comment. They have actually still not made any comment on it. It's a disgrace, really, in my opinion. Like a city that big, this big, 5 million people.
Jason Brewer, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.